Welcome to 74 Escapes new podcast series, Breaking Bread with Vera Lulu. I'm Vera, and I will take you on a gastronomic journey to explore food as an expression of cultural identity. I'll be hosting chefs and industry professionals from all over the world to discuss everything about this art form that really nourishes our souls. Let's start.
On this episode of Breaking Bread, I am so delighted to be speaking with Jeff Gaudinier. Jeff has covered not only the world of food for the New York Times and Esquire magazine, but as well as movies, music, poetry, and politics for publications as diverse as Fortune, Elle, and Travel and Leisure. Jeff is the author of highly regarded book, Hungry, Eating, Road Tripping, and Risking It All with the Greatest Chef in the World, a chronicle of the years he spent studying creativity and cuisine with noted chef René Redzepi of Noma in Copenhagen. He has appeared in the John Kwan episode of Netflix series Chef's Table and in Phil Rosenthal's Netflix series Somebody Feed Phil. And I welcome Jeff Gaudinier on this episode of Breaking Bread. Dear Jeff, how are you today?
I'm doing okay. Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
I'm so pleased to have you. I've been a longtime fan of yours.
No, it's nice. It's an interesting morning here because I was just reading the list of semi-finalists for the James Beard Awards here in the States, and it's a good list. There's always some attendant dispute and controversy with these lists, of course, as there always is with the Oscars, etc. But I think they're doing a good job. It's a very strong, diverse list. And I noticed, for instance, in the best new restaurants category, there were several places that we also honored in the past months at Esquire magazine in our own best new restaurants list, including Nang Jr.'s in Asheville, North Carolina, and Yang Ban Society in Los Angeles, which were two of my picks, and La Royale in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Cannes in Oregon. So that's always kind of gratifying to see that some of our team's picks at Esquire dovetail with the James Beard picks. It's just good to see good people getting recognized, you know. So there's also a nomination in the New York State category for a restaurant right across the river there. I'm right on the Hudson River here. And across the river is a town called Nyack. Mm-hmm. It's a village right near the bridge there. And there's a Filipino restaurant. Yeah, there's a place called Carandaria there that I put in Esquire's best new restaurants list back in 2018, I think. And it's a wonderful family-owned Filipino restaurant. I go there all the time with my kids. And I love to see them getting recognition. They're just really, really good people. So it's kind of neat. I don't know. Anyway.
One of my dear friends, he's Filipino and he's now back in Philippines, but he was really wildly recognized in Paris. So he grew up in Paris and he had a restaurant there. Now he's back in Philippines. So it's a wonderful thing. I can't wait to visit the restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lovely spot. You know, there's been a lot of changes in these lists and these awards over the past decade or so. And, you know, it's just a welcome thing. I mean, to see how much richer and how much smarter these lists are now than they were a decade ago.
Much more diverse and unexpected.
Yeah, it's just a true recognition of what hospitality really can be, you know, in different forms in different places. So, I'm not necessarily an optimist by nature, but, but I think I was kind of chuffed to see this particular James Beard lineup. So
very exciting. I can't wait to hear about it and find out. I'll be on the lookout.
Cool. You're in Paris, right?
No, I'm actually in New York.
Why did I think you were in Paris?
Well, because I was in Paris, I got back and unfortunately back to reality, but.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was confused about that. So, okay. So you're in New York. Okay. Well, yeah, you can drive up to Nyack, or there's not a train on that side of the river. There's a train on this side.
I had a friend who's live in Nyack, but it's been ages since I've been back there. But I would be happy to visit. I was in Paris for the holidays. I'm back. But Paris was lovely.
Yeah, I'm sure. My daughter was just in Paris for the past semester of her college, her junior year, and now she's in Greece. So she's having quite a year.
It was just wonderful. I spent all my summers in Greece growing up as a child. And
no way.
Yes, yes, yes. You really absorb the wonderful fish, and there's nothing like Greece. It's just pure simplicity.
And wow. Yeah. I've never been to Greece. No, it's my wife's favorite place in the world, or one of them.
And she's so simple and wonderful. Yeah.
Everybody I talk to who goes to Greece says basically you kind of eat the same thing every day.
It basically is. It's grilled fish, and I've been on every island possible, fancy or not. There's been an island where it's been maybe 100 people, and it's just whether you sail on a big yacht or a tiny little fishing boat where you're in a storm and you think you're gonna die, it's but you never know with Greece, because you know I think everybody's been on fantastic, you know, luxury boats, but when you really do it on a tiny little sailing boat that's probably the size of my couch here, but you told that, you know, you're going to get to the next island in the next couple of hours, and then there is a storm which is unpredicted, and you end up being trapped in the storm for, you know, something like 20 hours plus, and you can't leave the island. Once you arrive to an island for the next 4 days, you make the best of it, and yeah, you eat potatoes and goldfish and Greek salad.
My friend George McCallman was telling me that when he went to Greece, he fully understood the wisdom of the Mediterranean diet. Like after a week, he felt so good physically, you know.
I could live on grilled fish. That's what I do. Grilled fish, potatoes, Finnish, Mediterranean salad. But what I really want to know is, someone with such diverse interests, from film to music to politics, when did your interest in food come about?
Well, I had the good fortune to grow up in Southern California. Pasadena, near Los Angeles. Sometime in the New York area in my super, you know, young years. But when I was a teenager, I was blessed to be able to read Ruth Reichel and Jonathan Gold writing about restaurants and food culture in Los Angeles at that time. You know, they were just starting to make an impact. Ruth had not come to New York and worked at Gourmet in the New York Times yet. She worked for the Los Angeles Times. And Jonathan Gold was writing about music and food. And, you know, I just thought these writers were extraordinary. And, you know, it's difficult sometimes for people in 2023 to remember, but there was a time before Google and there was a time before Instagram. And, you know, at 16, 17, I mean, I didn't have necessarily the wherewithal to know about restaurants in other parts of the city other than word of mouth and print media, you know. So a friend might tell me about a Thai restaurant or something, but I, you know, until I read about the place through Ruth or Jonathan or other writers, sometimes that was the first time, you know, I became acquainted with that restaurant. And it just, it was a sort of consciousness shifting to realize that I happened to be in this wonderland of food in Los Angeles, you know, that right up the hill from where we lived was incredible Armenian food. And if you went, you know,
Persian,
you know, incredible taco trucks in Highland Park. And it fills me with sadness to say this, because there was just a mass shooting in Monterey Park, but Monterey Park was very, very close to where I grew up. And you know, it's a beautiful community. It's a beautiful, beautiful community. And we would go there for Chinese food, et cetera. It just, you know, any mass shooting, it's just incomprehensible and heartbreaking when it's at a place that you know.
It's difficult to write about food when there's been such an event. You can't boast about restaurants when it's...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's not even... Yeah, that's not even in on the radar. It's just... But, you know, that I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley. Pasadena is part of that. And if you know San Gabriel Valley, you know, it's some of the best Asian food in America.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, I mean, and some of the best Mexican food. And I mean, it's just it's an extraordinary place. So my friend Rich and I basically were on an endless tasting tour of the city, the area we grew up in, and learning through that. In fact, my friend Rich wound up being a chef for a while. He was a chef in Los Angeles and in Paris, and endured quite a bit of tedium and torment, I must say. You know, bad behavior being something we know about from, yeah. So he ended up leaving restaurants and going to business school and going in a different direction. But, you know, so, yeah, I mean, we're just kind of like teen food obsessives. And then, and anyway, oh, so I'm sorry, I'm a rambler. But so, you know, it didn't cross my mind at that point that even though I read Jonathan and Ruth and other incredible writers, I mean, it didn't really cross my mind.
A. Gill.
Oh, yeah, A. Gill is funny, you know. I don't think I knew about his work at that time.
Let's say Jill, but I know it's Gill, but it's you know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's, I think, like, it's, hey, yeah. Your last name. I can't help it. You told me, but I have to put an accent and a G and a.
Yeah, the Gordon. Yeah, yeah. I didn't really try to be a food writer. I mean, it was not necessarily my aspiration early on. I just wanted to write about culture and. Creative people, basically. Creative people intrigue me, always have. The way in which their work can transform us, help us see the world in a different way. So I originally mostly wrote about music and movies.
Bob Dylan.
Well, sure, yeah, sure. I mean, you know, that's, I mean, but I came to Bob Dylan in a, I mean, he's a huge cultural figure. He won the Nobel Prize. But I mean, when I was a, you know, a teenager, I came to Bob Dylan through an unusual portal, because I was very active in my church. I was very religious. And yeah. And so Bob Dylan, and what's that?
As a Catholic.
No, I'm not Catholic. No, I was raised Presbyterian. Oh. But basically there was like an evangelical wing of Presbyterianism or whatever in Southern California. I went to several Bible studies a week, and I mean, it's kind of hard to contemplate now in retrospect, but it was a huge part of my life. And Bob Dylan went through a born again Christian phase in the 80s. So I first heard his music kind of with intention after he put out the album Slow Train Coming, which was like a kind of, you know, his Jesus album. So, I mean, I there's unusual pathways I've taken, you might say.
I think you can have lots of conversations with my partner about.
Oh yeah.
He's number one fan. So.
Oh, of Dylan, yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, you know, a lot of what broke me out of a sort of mental framework I was in as a kid was poetry. And punk rock, you know. So I went to see The Clash when I was 14, and it just kind of woke me up, changed the way I looked at the world. And I was drawn to a lot of poets almost at random in the beginning. I mean, just randomly picking up things in the bookstore, in a bookstore called Vroman's in Pasadena. That's a pretty famous Southern California bookstore. I would go in there and just wander around and just sort of really, truly arbitrarily pick up books and flip through them. Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, to me, it's a wonderful way to drift, you know. So I picked up a book by Lawrence.
It's if you live in New York City, sorry to interrupt, I I have some books, I don't know what to do with them. And I made a point where I don't know if I should do a Kindle or just get a second storage, because it's just all over the place and then you become a hoarder. So
Vera, I'm not going to show you this room I'm in right now, but there's heaps. That table over there has like about 200 books on it.
Well, I have loads of shelves and they're packed and they're breaking, and then it's just storage after storage, and it's just, what do you do?
I still buy tons of books of poetry, and I review poetry for the New York Times now and then.
Do you read Russian poetry? Do you have any favorites?
Akhmatova, I'm probably saying your name.
Yes. Yeah. Are you a fan of Nabokov at all?
Well, sure. Yeah. But you know, sometimes I feel like, not just with Russian poetry, but any poetry in translation, I know I'm missing things, right? I mean, the music of poetry is so impossibly linked to the sound of the language. I mean, it just is that you're not just, you know, the sound of many of the English language poets I love, I can't really imagine it.
Byron.
You don't even get me started. I don't even know where to begin. I've had this bizarre practice for 14 years where I buy books of poetry based on, I go to a store and I flip through them, and if something leaps out at me,
mm-hmm.
I buy the book, right?
That's
not the practice. So then I come home and I open the book to that poem. I have some right here, and I type it up word for word, exactly the same spacing, and to sort of understand the music of the poem and the mechanics of the poem. And then I share it with 60 different friends. It's not a mass email. They each get it individually. So in fact, some chefs are on that list. Massimo Bottura has gotten the poems, Dominique Crenn, and I don't expect discussion. I don't necessarily, it's not a book club. Like if they do want to comment, it's lovely and I learn a lot from that, but it's really just a kind of gesture of community and sort of like secular prayer. I mean, there's probably still a sort of religious component of this for me. It's a kind of prayer, and it's a way to step aside from work and give yourself some rest and breathing in the middle of a day and type up a poem and share it. I don't do it every day, Vera. I used to do it every day, literally every day.
You're quite a romantic, like your bestie Frances Marmon.
I unfortunately probably am, much to my demise, my doom, I suspect. I also send people postcards.
Yes, I've heard about that.
Yeah, yes. I have pre-stamped postcards that I send to people.
But no wonder you got along so well with Francis. I mean, he's quite a romantic, isn't he?
Yeah, you could say that.
Enjoyed the article on him. I thought it was so beautiful and poetic.
Oh, thanks. Yes. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. He actually did, I work with an organization called Kotsban. It's like a cultural cultural festival park north of me in Tivoli, New York. And we had Francis come to a dinner this past, I mean, I guess it was fall. It was like very late summer, sort of the onset of fall. We had live music. We did a talk with Francis. It's really fun. I mean, it's interesting. I he's got this whole shtick that accompanies him, and his clothes and his pronouncements and romantic manner. When you actually eat his food,
I love his food, and
his food is great. I mean, he is a great.
My favorite thing in the world is a beef schnitzel, and nobody does.
Oh.
And I always get that every time in Miami, and I'm at Faena. I get his beef schnitzel. It's one of my favorite things in the world.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, like, he started the dinner in Tivoli with these empanadas, you know, that they were like heating up a la plancha. And I mean, everybody at this party was like, I've never had an empanada this good. It was really,
anybody who says my two loves in life is Paris and potatoes, that's me. I would say Paris is my second and potatoes is my number one. I could just have a potato a day or have potatoes anyway, and I'm sold. I'll sell.
Yeah, you know, I love potatoes so much. Oftentimes when if we do the kind of just steak and baked potatoes dinner here at home with my kids and everything, I will bake way more potatoes than I need. Like, I'll bake like 12 potatoes, and then I just chop them up all week in, like, put them in tacos, you know.
Well, potatoes, even potato vapor, everything I cook, whether it's a fish or steak, I have to have a potato on the side. And, you know, coming from very modest upbringing, where I was born in Siberia, my grandmother, she actually had a garden in outside of Moscow. She grew her own vegetables, and she would, I previously talked about in my podcast, it was a huge property and there was no irrigation system, nothing. She built her own wooden cottage where she would take a rest during the, in between of watering the plants and potatoes. Mm-hmm. So she would have this wooden thing on her shoulders, which she would carry buckets of water to water all the vegetables and potatoes. Right. And scarecrows that she built up, and so she would dig the potatoes, and everything was stored underneath the ground. And if it was, you know, cucumbers and tomatoes, we would pickle them. And nice. Whatever was left, the temperatures were allowing for it to be underground and stored underneath the ground. So yeah. We would have just potatoes in baskets. And you have potatoes for the whole year. So
nice.
As a child of World War II, that's all they ate. She said, we didn't even have bread. All we had was potatoes. But up until she died, her favorite meal was potatoes. And and I think every Russian, it's like, not to make a correlation, but, you know, Italians love their pasta. You grew up with it. You know, in Asian culture, you respect rice. You love the rice. For the Russians, we love our potatoes. It's just what you grew up with, and whatever you're doing it doesn't matter.
Did you know where I've been is Novosibirsk? I've actually been to Siberia.
My father was born there.
No way.
Yes, my father was born and raised there, and I am from Yakutsk. So it's I don't remember much of it. I was 3 years old when we moved to Moscow. But my family is from Novosibirsk and Yakutsk.
I've done the Banya there and the whole thing out in the taiga. Like, I mean, I wrote a piece for Details magazine years ago about Maxim Vengerov. You know him, the violinist. Yes. He's from Novosibirsk.
Uh-huh. So, I do. Yeah.
So I went home with him, basically.
So it's so fascinating that Francis, who, you know, is from Spanish, from South America. It's when he did his 9 course, I read the article on it, 9 course menu on potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
My heart started to beat, and I thought it was just so beautiful. And I thought I'd never meet somebody. I never met him personally, but I never met a person who loves potatoes as much as me.
Awesome. Where do you eat in New York City?
Where do I eat?
Yeah.
I'm, to be quite honest, I cook a lot, obviously, for a living. That's my main job. And at home, I eat very simple. I like to eat grilled branzino, yada, yada, oysters. But, you know, Ignacio Matos is one of my favorites, of course. We've done that with him. I like pure food, although I must say one of my favorites is Aska as well. Frederick, unbelievable.
Interesting.
I'm a big fan of Cesar from Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair.
Oh, wow. Okay, interesting. Wow, this is very interesting. Well, I think Ignacio is, you know, is the man.
Of course, Atomix. Yeah. But I must mention a restaurant that is so underrated for some reason. Jungsik, which is a Korean fine dining. Absolutely love it. I do love sushi, of course, but, you know, being in Tokyo, you're spoiled. But, you know, sushi Amane, sushi Noz, anything that's really omakase, huge, huge fan.
I'm supposed to go to Yoshino tomorrow night.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah, that Pete Wells from the New York Times gave 4 stars to it. And I'll be completely candid. I mean, I cannot afford that. But a friend can and is very generously taking me along. So, you know, so I got to ask you, I want to ask you some questions because you love Asuka and Atomix. Like, how do you feel about fine dining? Fine dining is in this position right now of controversy and crisis. People wondering.
I think it's a very relative concept. I do 100% appreciate it. You know, I'm the kind of person, I'm very extreme in every way, whether it's art, food, or fashion. Uh-huh. I can buy a little decoration for the house, it's $2, and then it can be an art that's, you know, really massive. And it's the same way with fashion and food for me. So listen, I'm happy sometimes with McDonald's. I love fast food, not on a daily basis, of course, but absolutely love fine dining as well. So it's such a relative concept. I mean, you know, like we talked about back in the 80s, Red Lobster was fine dining, but what's fine dining? Do I want to do it every day? I don't. It's an experience, and I think if it's done well, but from my humble upbringing in Russia, for me, it was a lot of homemade food, and I grew up on just even a meatball and a pickle and a potato, and I was super happy. And mm-hmm. on a daily basis, because I cook so much, especially for clients that are, can be quite into fine dining. I cook a lot of that. So when I come home, I don't want to have that. I want to have a chicken noodle soup, and I want to have a baked potato or just a meatball or like a piece of bread with cheese and butter. So, but I do love chefs and what they do. And for me, it's a challenge as well to experience. And if I travel, most of it has to do with food as well. So for me, it's a wild range. You know, tomorrow I might just do like a penne with a Parmigiano cheese and butter, olive oil. And then in 2 days, I'll go to Asuka. So it's a balance. Mm-hmm. and that being said, I'm a huge fan, of course, of Daniel Rose and Le Coucou. Mm-hmm. And I think Ignacio Matos does an incredible job of doing small plates that are quite interesting. They're simple, but, you know, they're just really creative plates without mm-hmm. being too, like, I could eat that every day, you know, and that's the part that New York is missing. It's, hey, do you want to do Italian or is it Chinese? I feel like European scene has a lot more to give, where it's a bit more creative, where you have to decide what kind of cuisine I'm having, where I can have a mm-hmm. little bit of everything, you know? Mm-hmm. But, I love it all. So honestly, it could be Chinese, it could be cheap Chinese, or I can go to Shanli, or I can go to Estella tomorrow. And it could be Asuka once every couple months or Chef's Table Book and Fair. And I could really do a really nice omakase once a month. So I really love it all. I can't help it. And if my mom calls me and she says, hey, I'm making cabbage rolls, I'll be right over in Queens. So food is food and it's tastier when somebody else makes it, because when you do, it's what you made. So I'm happy.
I've never been to Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair.
Oh, it's incredible. I think what Cesar does is absolutely impeccable every time. It's just impeccable. Hmm. And ingredients and it's just, oh, I think he's a genius, really. Hmm. I think fine dining, in especially New York City, is still a little bit behind, where some restaurants are given 3 stars, 2 stars. But if I was in Europe, I wouldn't give them those stars. But 100% Cesar, even if he was in Europe, I would. It's worth it, you know. And Michelin can be tricky, yes, but Schiff's Table Book on Fairies, to me, it's just flawless. Flawless in every time, every dish. It's impeccable. Not to mention the service, and they're just amazing. So, yeah. And I'm very happy they survived, unfortunately, COVID. And yeah. but like I said, yeah, I'm a huge fan of Ignacio as well. I know we talked.
Yeah, Ignacio, it's so distinctive what he does. And it's kind of hard to put a finger on it.
And I was so shocked when he closed Flora Bar. I was right.
Well, Flora Bar, that broke my heart.
I live uptown. So for me, it's, you know, neighborhood restaurants, Madison Avenue, it's a bit mainstream, yes?
Yeah.
So when you work so much and you have like one day off, I have to plan a meal, it's a bit difficult. Sometimes you just want to be lazy, and I can even order pizza from Serafina or even go to Shake Shack, right? Greasy. For me to make a commitment to go out for a meal, especially downtown, it's an effort because it's, you know, 45 minutes in a taxi, metro, whatever. You have to really be committed. And that was my only go-to uptown. That was diverse, cool, and beautiful room. And that closed, I said, wow, there is nothing more uptown that's on that level, which was just fun.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know if you get this, but I get asked just about every day where to eat in New York. People email me, DM me, and I have an ever-evolving cut-and-paste list, right? But usually they say, no, I want to eat, in Midtown. Or they say, I want to eat in the Upper East Side because that's where my hotel is or something. And I'm like, just go downtown, please. Like, or go uptown. But just, like, I have recommendations in all these different neighborhoods, but not really Upper East Side. I mean, and it used to be Flora Bar. I'd say, well, Flora Bar, you know, is just extraordinary.
And the room.
But, the room, yeah. But that was kind of a crusher. My wife and I were really smitten with that place. I mean, they had a great Tuxedo Number 2 cocktail. They had a.
I know about this. You mentioned it was one of your favorite things.
Yeah, it was probably my favorite cocktail. I mean, there's different ones. I had this wonderful martini at the Progress in San Francisco that I still remember that had, like, you know, droplets of olive oil floating on top. But I'll be, you know, honestly, I don't drink anymore. So, I haven't really. What's that?
Mocktails for you.
No, I don't like mocktails for the most part. I mean, they're not bitter enough. I have a very bitter heart. And it's not, I mean, I don't care if it's a podcast. It's not like an AA thing or something like that. It really is like I'm 56. And I found that drinking was becoming more of a negative than a positive in my life. It just affects my sleep, my skin, my mood, my weight. It just sort of was dragging me down. And this became acutely noticeable in the beginning of the pandemic, like spring of 2020. I was stuck at home after traveling pretty much almost nonstop for 30 years. As a journalist, I was stuck at home, you know, and make myself a Negroni and have half a bottle of wine. And I was like, I don't think this is sustainable, you know, and I don't think this is good for me. And I have toddler twins who wake up at 5:36 every morning and usually wake up with great hostility, like jump on me and elbow me. And I was like, this is not going to work. So I've actually had periods of my life where I didn't drink and I always feel better. There's more clarity. There's deeper sleep. Now, I will say, like, if you look at the recent Esquire Best New Restaurants list that I helped
I did look choose. At it.
Yeah, I chose and wrote about our cocktail guru of the year, Colleen Hughes. And I went to Supperland in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is one of the restaurants she works at. And I had her cocktails. I mean, I'm not like a Puritan about it. I when I'm doing work for Esquire that involves sampling the cocktails or the wine, I will have a sip. And I'm not, you know, an extremist like that. So usually there's this bandwidth of time in which I'm kind of occasionally drinking as research to do my job. But otherwise don't. I never drink at home. And if I'm going to a restaurant where I'm not considering it for Esquire, I don't drink at all. In fact, you know, I recently went to La Bernardin. Again, a friend brought me along, and I was with another friend of a friend of his who's a major figure in the wine world and was ordering all sorts of extraordinary wines. And I mean, it was rough there for a second, because I was like, damn, I really I have a feeling I'm missing out on some real highlights here. But you know, when I woke up the next day, I was glad I stuck to my guns, because I just felt better, you know. A. Gill didn't drink, you know, he was actually recovering alcohol.
Bernardin, I think Eric is fantastic. Sue me if I say so. Is it worth 3 stars in my opinion? Not, I don't think so.
Maybe wow.
US in general, yes. I think he's a fantastic chef. His pristine ingredients, but I have a hard time finding it at a 3-star restaurant, if you ask me.
Wow. You mean 3 Michelin stars? Because La Bernardin has 3 Michelin stars and 4 New York Times stars. Correct. And I believe it's the only New York. It's
that only concept, and I will never change it. And
yeah,
he can be mad all he wants, and I think he's a chef. But I just, to me, it's a 2 1-star anywhere in Europe. So, you know.
Interesting.
I had great.
That's meetings. Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's great, but I find it a little bit. It's like in something, but I do love it. I mean, I enjoy it. Yes, every time I go, I haven't been in a while. But I think I've started to, and especially when you're in Europe and when you're in Paris, it's such a different quality of food. And even if you go to a brasserie and you get the Plateau de Mer, there is nothing like it here. You get Scottish langoustines, you get the oysters from Normandy. It's such a different quality of food in itself, even if it's a simple sole. I think as much as New York is diverse, because you can have fantastic Japanese and Italian and old school Italian and you know, American Italian and whatever that is, and good Chinese, and you have Shanli, it's diversity. But the country is still a bit behind versus, you know, Japan, versus Europe, versus it's still, I think we have a lot to learn. And I think it's people's mentality, to be quite honest.
When I, you know, what's weird for me is when I go to a city where the food culture is somewhat monochromatic, you know, like I had a day once in Bologna, as obviously it's a great privilege to be in Bologna, and the food there is extraordinary. But it's also, for a Los Angeles boy, it's weird, because it's basically just, you know, the food of Bologna everywhere. Every restaurant has the same dishes, and there's like maybe tiny wrinkles of difference, but like basically the same pastas, the same, you know, tortellini and brodo. And I mean, you know, I grew up with.
When in Rome, do as Romans. It's how.
Yeah, but I can't imagine living there. Like
I would be completely bored. But you know what I find, New York aside, to me the most incredible food destination is Japan, because Japanese, they will take every culture that you can possibly think of, and perfect it. It's not like you can go to Italy and have the most amazing Japanese. You can have okay Japanese. You can go to, you know, any other country in the world and have their local food, because when I travel, I like to eat local. But Japan, in my opinion, is the only country that can take every cuisine you can possibly think of, even pizza, Italian food, or Russian food, or whatever that is, and perfect it to the max. I've had better French food in Japan and better Japanese, we're in Japan, but they do everything to such a, they will take everything and perfect it to such a level that you just stunned. I've had better pastries in Japan than I did in France.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
They're just out of their minds. I don't know if that's the Japanese.
It's just a commitment to perfection and to the best ingredients, you know.
I've had Russian food in Japan and I said, I can't believe it. And when I told Italians that I had fantastic pizzas and pastas in Japan, they said, it's not possible. I said, I am telling you, there is so many chefs who do unbelievable pizza and pasta in Japan, and they could not comprehend it. But Japanese is just their work ethic and how much they work and their source of ingredients and just their work ethic. They will do everything to make it better than your own country. So I think Japan is not just good for Japanese food, but to me it was mind-blowing how much they can take something that's not their own and make it 10 times better than your own. So that was the beauty of Japan when I was there and lived there for a short period of time. But
well, my experience recently and briefly in Japan certainly brought that home in terms of just like the airports, for instance, like the soba I had in the airport, the Haneda airport in Tokyo, mm-hmm. was better than really just almost any soba you could find in the United States. And this was not
7-Eleven food in between.
Yeah, the 7-Eleven. Yeah, I mean,
I have better sushi at 7-Eleven than I do in some of the restaurants in New York City where I pay top dollar for. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, even like I was in a park, a public park in Matsuyama, mm-hmm. which is not a city people name a lot in terms of food culture in Japan, and weird circumstances why I was there, but I was there and it was a lovely town. And I noticed that there was an older couple that had a truck parked there, and I walked over and they were selling yakitori just out of the back of the van, basically. And I mean, this yakitori was extraordinary. You know, they had they had so much care they were putting into it. And I was like, well, you know, obviously there's these super high end, like Michelin starred yakitori places.
But even then, it's so affordable. It's less than here.
My whole lunch from the couple at the van was like $6 or something. And I mean, I was like, I'll have that.
$6 won't get you a coffee at Starbucks in New York City. So.
No, it was, but you're right. Yeah. It's really interesting. I mean, I still remember I had a very brief time in Tokyo, and I mean, very brief, like, I mean, not even a full day. I basically was going to check into a hotel and then go to sleep and have to go to the airport. So, but obviously you want to pack in as much as you can. And I found out there was a sushi place. Also the hours, like I checked in the hotel at like 3 in the afternoon, and there was not much open because there's places open for lunch hours and then dinner hours. But at 3 is like this ghost town. There was nothing open then. So I found out there was a more casual sushi place, literally a block away, that was open all day. So I just went in there. Because I was like, I got to get some sushi, you know, even if it's not, you know, the most famous place. I want to have
some. You have to reserve years before and months before if you really want to go to, like, you know, sushi.
Yeah,
sushi.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, I was
even sushi belts are better than most of the high restaurants here. So,
well, that's what I'm saying. I went to this place. I just walked a block from the hotel, walked in, sat at the counter, and was blown away.
Yeah,
it was so great. And I mean, it was like not expensive, not fancy, not famous. And I'm sure there are many, many levels, of course, beyond it. But I was so satisfied and so happy. The quality of the rice, the quality of the fish. It's something else. You know, I mean, but, you know, I find that to be the case in Mexico, too, with the quality of tortillas and you know, the ingredients are often just better in the place they're from. You know, that's just the truth.
Let's talk a bit about Francis.
You're obsessed with Francis.
Oh, he's such a romantic, and he drinks wine in the morning, and he loves and appreciates women. And I love how he thinks that they're better.
He does.
It's just so charming, and he's one of the chefs that is just so appreciative and so just really just a romantic, where he's not romanticized by I think media, but just in general. And you know,
he's very polarizing. You know, it's funny to hear your response, because I've heard a wide range of responses to the very existence of Francis Moleman, from I'm in love with him to, He represents the, you know, the last ashes of the patriarchy. I've heard it all, and in a way, everyone's correct.
Listen, anybody
he probably wouldn't even deny the patriarchy part.
He loves cinema, you know, he loves French film, and from what
I've cultured, he's a cultured gentleman.
Very
yeah,
cultured, watches movies, and.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story.
Watching films and how he cooks, and as I grow older, I used to be so into gastronomy, and I still appreciate it, like I said, fine dining. But honestly, sometimes I just want like a grilled bread with tomatoes and a baked potato and some meat. It's really so simple at the end of the day.
Yeah, the best thing I had when I went to Francis's Island in Patagonia, I mean, his cooking is really great. I gotta say, you gotta experience it. You're like, oh my god, he does have something. It doesn't, you don't necessarily, you can't necessarily tell from afar, but when you're eating it, you're
very
like
shocked to hear. And sorry to interrupt you, because
it's all right.
Like most of people, I was thinking you arrive in its gorgeous mountains and lakes, and what you described in the beginning. I was so shocked. I said, oh my goodness, it doesn't turn me off. I will still go through that with the rain boots and a coat. I'm a Siberian, but
oh yeah,
you have this image of Patagonia, you arrive and it's a beautiful little heaven. Obviously it's not. You have to go through excruciating 24-hour travel, which also I'm comfortable with, but it's not you, it's not like you arrive and you're in this piece of palms and
I mean when I went, it was winter, it was their winter, you know, so it was cold as hell,
dirt and snow,
yeah. And I was tired, I mean, but you know that it's really true with him that the best things he cooks are the simple things, and
love that.
I mean, almost everything is simple, but like he had two things I will say that I had in Patagonia. One was this
crap or the lamp soup.
Well, the crepe with dulce de leche is just it's extraordinary. But I mean, he made this kind of Persian buttered rice. It wasn't quite a tadig, but it was like it wasn't quite that. It was just basically rice in a skillet with a lot of butter, like a lot of butter.
I actually cook for Persians, and they are American Persian, but I make tadig at least week. So I would love to think that I perfected it, but it's every time I flip it, it's my heart is like, you never know. But every time it really comes out and you got that beautiful crust, and it's such a, you don't have a control over it. It's not like you can sear the chicken or sear the beef or chop tuna tartare. You really don't know what's happening there, and depending on the humidity. So every time I'm thinking it's going to be great, and then you flip it, it's just a bit darker, or it's a little bit not dark enough, you know. So it's always like my heart is, it's almost like as if I'm doing a brain surgery. My heart is beating, and every time I flip, it's a 50-50. So when that D comes out perfect, It's
nice.
The stress of my entire day, because if I know if I'm cooking tadig that day, I'm having heart palpitations like crazy. And if it comes out great, I know I've done well for the day.
So. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful dish. I mean,
I've got a grandpa who's 97 years old and he's a Persian. So him judging me and I'm there just sweating and all day. If I know I have to make that dig, I can't even sleep the night before.
Really? Wow. I'm sorry I brought it up. I didn't mean to upset you.
That's why I cannot watch The Bear, because I watched a couple episodes and it gives me anxiety. So after coming home from work, that's the last thing I want to watch.
Yeah, almost all the chefs I know have said that they, I mean, they think that The Bear is very true to life, but it's triggering and it's almost upsetting. I mean, I really think The Bear is like Breaking Bad or The Wire. I think it's one of the great.
But if you're in the industry, you know, I come home, I want to watch Curb Your Enthusiasm and laugh. And Bear is great, but maybe I want to do it like on my vacation where it doesn't take me back to my job where I have anxiety.
Oh yeah.
But yeah. Fabulous show. Yes, it's great. But back to Francis.
Back to Francis. Here we go. I mean, he also did this thing where he just basically dumped a bunch of tomatoes on the plancha and let them burn, like they were just scorched. Potatoes? What's that?
What about potatoes?
Oh, he did. He does all different things with potatoes. You know, there's so much versatility to potatoes. So he does all sorts of different variations. I mean, the way he and I first interacted was interesting because I went to Miami to research to check out bars, basically, mm-hmm. for Esquire's annual best bars list, and I was near the Faena Hotel, and like, you know, I went to Los Fuegos, his restaurant there, and Francis was there, mm-hmm. and we talked, and he was like, you know, I don't want to talk to you. I find men boring. And he's like, I don't want to talk about food. You know, it's okay. We don't have to talk about food. He finds conversations about food culture tedious, and he seemed to find me tedious. Certainly not the first person to feel that way. And, but then I brought up, I think almost accidentally, I brought up poetry. And my, you know, ongoing poetry practice and the fact that I write about poetry. And he's like, oh, tell me more. Who do you like to read? And then we had basically the whole meal, we had this conversation about different poets. This sounds so pretentious, I know. But, you know, it's genuine. It's a genuine passion of his, and it's a genuine passion of mine. It's in some ways my form of worship, you know. And so... near the end of this conversation, he's like, you should come to the island. And I was like, come to the island? What? What?
That's how you ended up there.
Yeah. I mean, he was just kind of rant. He was like, I'd passed the test somehow because of, like, I knew about Yehuda Amakai and other poets. And so he was like, culturally, I'd pass some sort of like, test. You know, litmus test. Yeah. And so I don't know. I asked my editors at Esquire, you know, should I go? And they're like, yeah, go. Like, you know, right. And so it was kind of random. He is interested in poetry, film, music. And if you have an interest in those things, then he loves to talk about it. And he will engage with, he doesn't necessarily want to sit around and talk about food. What's that?
Listen to? What's his music interest?
Oh, you know, he likes a lot of the 60s hippie stuff, basically. Like Laurel Canyon stuff. Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He loves Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He loves Neil Young, Joni Mitchell.
European stuff. Serge Gainsbourg. Didn't you mention that?
He probably likes Serge. Who doesn't? But I mean, he had a period where he lived in California, Francis. He actually got independence from his parents at a young age and traveled. Yeah, I mean, I haven't reread my story in years, so I don't know. You know more about it than I do. But he moved to California and traveled up and down the coast. I think he lived in Santa Barbara for a while. And he was just sort of enamored by the freedom of, you know, the sort of folk singer scene. And he plays guitar. He sings. Actually, when he did this dinner in the Hudson Valley here last fall, we had live music from a band called Milton. That's a lovely band, and they can play just about anything, but they know a lot of those songs. And at some point, Francis just joined them on guitar and sang with them. So, he's unusual in that way. He wants to hear what you're passionate about with culture. You know,
I absolutely love that.
Yeah, I can tell. he's interesting. You know, I talk to him now and then. He's curmudgeonly. You know, he doesn't mind an argument too. He's an interesting person. So, but you know where I really would love to go to some of the other. I mean, I've only been to Argentina in South America, which I'm sort of embarrassed about. Like, I'd love to go to Uruguay, I'd love Colombia.
All over the world, but unfortunately not so much in South America. But Yeah, and did a podcast with Virgilio, but I have so many.
Oh, yeah.
Before, but life is so, you know, it's, I'm still young, but there's so many things to see and experience. And
indeed.
I've been all over, you know, Europe and Asia and Africa as well. So there's still so many destinations, but yeah, life is also, you know, you have to, you know, there's so many things to see. You can't, it's a big,
yeah. You know who I saw just a few days ago was Mikhail Baryshnikov, because I have some friends who work with the Baryshnikov Arts Center. Yeah, here in the city. And so, in fact, Kotzban up in the Hudson Valley has sort of an affiliation with a Baryshnikov Arts Center. So I was talking with Misha. I know this is name dropping, but it was pretty exciting. I mean, it's pretty exciting to talk. I mean, he's one of the great cultural figures of our time, you know, and a lovely person.
How do you feel about Russian food?
Well, you know, I was going to say this is like he loves goat. He loves eating goat meat. And in fact, I've had a couple of conversations with Misha about.
I mean, it's a big part of Indian culture as well.
Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I get the sense that he likes robust food, you know, and not necessarily simple, but like robust flavors and earthy, you know. Yeah, fascinating. It's always I'm gonna sound terrible. This is the worst. I mean, I don't blame your audience for being like he's a name dropping jerk. But at this same event on Monday night, I happened to speak for the first time ever with Patti Smith, you know, who's a famous rock and roll legend, National Book Award winner. And Patti Smith has been a hero of mine since I was 15, 14, I don't know, around the time I heard The Clash, saw The Clash in concert. And I was quite nervous to meet her. But it's interesting because she and I mostly talked about sardines.
Oh, I love sardines.
My motto is
I don't trust anybody who doesn't like sardines.
Well, yeah.
We cannot be friends if you don't like sardines.
it leaves out a lot of people. I mean, but
but that's why I don't have a lot of friends.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, neither do I. Maybe that explains it. But she apparently has this, you know, the Brisling sardines, the smaller ones that I think are better.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the stuff. So she makes
too.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you sound like a real connoisseur, real expert. Apparently, Patti makes a sandwich like every day where she toasts some oat bread.
My lunch every day.
I will tell you
a really funny story. So I went back to Lisbon, which is one of my favorite cities other than Paris, obviously. And, you know, it just got so busy. We were shopping and drinking and eating and seeing friends after COVID, of course. And the entire time I said, you know, I need to stock up on things and especially canned goods because they're just amazing. Of course, I didn't do any of that. In a rush, we packed and here we are at the airport and there is this cute shop which has all the canned goods, you know, the cute one.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and we're not late to the flight, but the airport was a bit weird. So my partner runs alone and he's at the cute gate almost 45 minutes later. I have security and him running to me and saying, they're about to take off the plane. What the hell are you doing? I said, well,
oh, no.
And I'm like with three bags of canned goods. I said, what do you mean? I'm getting smoked sardines. And so I was willing to miss a flight
That's funny.
Smoked fish and soda. And he was so angry with me, poor thing. But yes. So anyway, I still have some goods from Portugal, but getting low over there. But
I could eat like Portuguese cuisine is sort of, again, like I said about Bologna, I would never want to be limited to the same cuisine all the time because I just grew up having so many different types of cuisine. But there is something about, there's something about Portuguese food culture that resonate that I love so much, you know, the fresh sardines and
tourist, and they have everything that you can have. So they have seafood and fantastic oysters, by the way, and they also do amazing meat. So it's you never really get bored. And although it's not typical for Lisbon, but we did experience this amazing restaurant, which was Asian. I forgot the name, but it was next to our Airbnb, and they did fantastic Asian food as well. Oh. So we were not bored there for a second. And for a person that, you know, I can, you know, eat different things every day, but I still tend to get bored in different cities. So for us, it was just always so much fun. And
there's a clam dish in Portugal that's
it's the best. You
know, yeah, named after a poet there, and it has like cilantro and garlic and
it's at Ramiro. It's where Anthony Bourdain went as well.
Yeah, I mean, but it's everywhere. It's like in every restaurant. And my wife was
different. They're so buttery and they're small and the shape is different.
I ordered it every place. Like, and I ordered it, I would even have it for breakfast. I would just keep having it. And I'd like to see how it was interpreted differently and different. But my wife was like, please stop with that clam dish. Are you like branch out, you know? But, you know, it's just some wonderful. It's such a treat. So, yeah, and that's how I feel about sardines, too. I mean, it was funny talking to Patty Smith and that, like, okay, all these years, you know, I'm 56 and, you know, like 40 years, I've, like, been fixated on Patty Smith's writing and music, and here I am talking with her about a sardine sandwich. Like, that's what it's come to. Okay. It was like my life has some strange arcs.
Well, you also love David Bowie. Imagine you met him and he said, I'm not a fan of seafood, or I don't really care about what I eat. I mean, how would you feel about him?
You know, I interviewed Bowie a couple times. He used to kind of habituate occupy Emilio's Bellotto in New York City. Do you know Emilio's Bellotto? Mm-hmm. He used to like eat there all the time. I think he and Iman lived close to there. So I know he liked to eat. Did he not like seafood? Did you hear that?
No, I'm just throwing this out. For example.
Oh, okay. You kind of freaked me out there. I was like, I don't remember him having any resistance to particular foods. I mean, I will say that I was distressed by his smoking. We've all got our faults. We've all got our vices. I get bummed when people smoke because, you know, it's going to probably shorten your life. But I'm not one to pass judgment. You know, he was a real gentleman both times I interviewed him. He was on, not only on time, he was early for both interviews, which is really rare with celebrities when you have the opportunity to meet them. Keanu Reeves was also early. He was really, really cool guy.
Oh, I know. I've seen him a couple of times, Café de Fleur. But
oh, yeah?
I'm sure we can speak for many more hours and we should get lunch and dinner and just talk more. It's been so exciting. But my cool. biggest question is, you do have twins. Cook for them? What is it like with them? Do they like the same things? What's their... Coming from a foodie like you, what do you cook for them? What do they like?
Yeah, I have four children actually. My daughter who's in Greece right now, and my son who's in high school, and then the twins who are nearing five. It's funny, Vera, because they're not identical. They're fraternal twins, and they're extraordinarily different. Different hair, different. TV shows they like, different activities they like to do, different personalities. And so Jasper is extraordinarily picky. I mean, the kind of picky that drives you nuts if you love food, like really likes the white foods. You sometimes see children have this, they like, you know, yogurt, white bread, American cheese. He really likes these kind of bland touchstones. It kind of torments me. And then Wesley is opposite. He's like the adventurous one. He'll eat anything. He loves chili peppers. He likes pickles. He'll eat spicy things. He'll eat sour things. Sometimes he'll say, oh, I don't like that, but he will always try it. And he'll often just grab foods off people's plates and try them. He's like a beast. He just kind of, And I don't know how this will play out. So we cook, you know, I kind of try to, my wife or I, or you know, my other members of my family, we try to create kind of a range of things to see what they like. And sometimes, you know, Jasper just has the rice. I make a lot of rice. I like rice.
Kind of like my job. So I make different things for the entire family where people only want rice and simple things like paillard, but then it's more adventurous stuff for the adults and this and
there
that.
There you go. It's the same. It's like being a private chef. Having four kids is like being a private chef. And, you know, I in terms of parenting, I have learned some, you know, having this arc of ages, I've learned a lot about the role that you play in terms of introducing your children to culture and food. Essentially, you're kind of planting seeds. You don't know which seeds will blossom, will flourish, right? Like, but the best the children are essentially hardwired when they're born. They have certain personality traits, sure, physical traits. They're just from the start, and you really can't influence that.
It's also even though you kind of conditions, because we are in America, we're a bit privileged, but if we are in Afghanistan or Iran, listen, if there's this on the table, you eat it, otherwise you're hungry. But it's a beautiful, sure, thing to know that we're in a country where this child just wants fish sticks, so this one wants tuna tartare. So voila. So they're so lucky to have us to be able to bring this produce to them and make them happy. And they grow up with a range of cuisines and things and have access to that.
Yeah, I just try to take them. You know, my son Toby was in high school. He did go through a picky phase, but I would take him out to restaurants, you know, as much as possible, not places where he would have been disruptive or something, but introduce him to Filipino food, Korean food, Taiwanese food, etc. You know, and he's just about to turn 17 in 2 days. You know, these are the cuisines he craves. Now, this is like he's actually quite bored by standard American fare and wants constantly to find flavor and spice and pungency. And I mean, part of the role you play as a parent is just making sure they're aware of that and have a range of experiences so that they approach the world with openness, really, you know, instead of resistance. It's more about cultivating openness, open-heartedness, and an open mind and an open palate. And so I've seen that bears fruit, right, in my children, and it's good to see. So I have a feeling that Jasper someday will loosen his grip on American cheese. I hope.
Well, Jeff, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. Really can't wait to share Negroni and get a couple of bites in some of our favorite restaurants, whatever we choose. And thank you for being on this wonderful podcast. It's been such a pleasure.
Cool.
And you're first journalist, so it's been really, really, really fascinating for me.
Cool. Vera, it's nice talking to you. Thank you so much for your time. Okay. Have a good day and good week and a good year and all that stuff.
And we'll be in touch.
Cool. Okay.